Welcome to Beginner's Mind, an exploration through conversations that allow everyday people to see uncertainty as a space of discovery, growth, and acceptance. My name is Damaris Ferrer. I'm a movement educator helping people better understand the body-mind connection.
My name is Francisco Paco Lugo Viña. My Buddhist name is Genkoji. I'm a Zen master helping people through their mental and spiritual constipations.
Yes, you heard that correct. Together, we offer guidance through our own personal stories by tapping into the human experiences we all share.
Hello, Damaris. Suggestion, you be the timekeeper, and let's do 30 seconds of silent meditation in which we try to center ourselves in terms of the work that we're going to do today. Is that okay with you?
Yes, sounds
good. Okay, so I'll do one clap to start us going, and you'll do one clap to end us. Amen. So today we've chosen to explore how to find joy in your work. And maybe you have been a creator pretty much all your life, having chosen to be a person, movement, dancing, you have gone to school to learn about that when you were a child, and then you tour Europe, and then you tour the United States. Let's see if we could define two words, joy and work, so that we're both on the same page, because my sense of it is that everyone has a different definition of work and a definition of joy. So why don't you start with that if you can?
That's funny that you ask that, because throughout my career, I don't think I ever said, I'm going to work. It was always, I'm going to a rehearsal. I'm going to a concert. I'm going to perform. I'm going to teach. I'm going on tour. I never said, I have to get up and go to work. Right? Not until recently, funny enough. And I don't know if that runs through for other creatives, for other artists, right? That our work is, we consider it more our craft. And that, I guess the word also implies something that gets done. And in art and art making and in creative processes, I don't think we ever think we're done. We're never done. So maybe that's why it's always like this action in process. So maybe that's why the word work didn't really fit. I don't think there was always joy, because I think that in everything we do and in anything we do, whether we are passionate about it or not, there are always those days and those moments where you're not feeling that joyful. It's not going that great, right? Or you're not that happy with the outcome. But in general, it's good to think about, especially for, you know, this is something I was just having a conversation yesterday with my students at Nova Southeastern University about courses that should be included in school, right? You know, how do children find themselves before they sort of just match themselves with some random thing that later they find out they're not really interested in, or it's not interesting to them, or maybe they're just choosing a career because it's something their parents did, or I know a lot of students who are just chasing the money, right? and then they're miserable. But I think part of finding joy has to do with an early discovery or acceptance of who you are, or the fact that who you are is just who you are at the moment. Things are still going to change and get better or get worse before they get better. And I think that the lack of joy is mostly because we're always sort of frustrated with ourselves.
Hmm. I don't know when the word work came into being, but I suspect it might have had something to do with the Industrial Revolution, when people began to show up to entities like factories or things like that, or perhaps when the English discovered that you could go in the ground and get coal out of the ground to create energy for the different kinds of things that were being invented, like the steam engine and things like that. Maybe miners never said, I'm going to work. They say, I'm a miner. So I think that at some point there was a level of vocation and avocation, and your avocation became something that was your lifelong work. I'm going to use work, but your lifelong pursuit. And there was an era before the Industrial Revolution where you went and you decided to be a bricklayer or an artist or whatever it is, and you did an internship. It's not called an internship at that point. It was called something else. When you went to a taller to study with the master, and you signed a contract with the master that you would stay in that situation for so many years before the master said you were able to master whatever the trade was, and then you went on your own, or maybe you stayed with the master. And that went from being a sculptor to being a painter. So all these guys like Michelangelo and Da Vinci all had shops, you know, with tons and tons of artists working with them. And not all of these famous people's work was done solely by them. There were contributions for that. So work, I think, is a word that more of a modern creation. When I started my career, I went on a job at work and did not like it at all. So I graduated in 1964 from the university. By 1968, I had created my own company, November 4th, 1968. And even though it was working, it never felt like work. I never went to work. You know, it was my own company with people working for me, and I had partners. There were people who worked for me, but I never considered myself going to work. And I agree with your definition of joy, that joy has something to do with how comfortable you are inside your own skin. And what are the kinds of things that you have developed about answering the question, who am I? Or what do I stand for? That there is the philosopher Spinoza, who was a Dutch philosopher, would say he related being to be, the oneness. In my lineage of the Zen peacemakers, we call it the oneness of life, the one. Spinoza, back when he was doing his philosophy, talked about this energy pool that exists in the world, and that we'll see a tree and we'll name it a tree, but if we take the word tree, it's an energy form. And it's the same energy form that creates us. So without getting too far into the woods about that, it's how we feel about ourselves. What is our worldview? And that creates a sort of joy and joyousness. And the joyousness is that state that sometimes we find, most of the time we're not there, where we have this sense of happiness, this sense of contentment, and doesn't mean that things are all going 100% our way. We still might have trouble paying our rent or our gas bill or our car payment or whatever it is. But even in spite of those things, there is a level of contentment and understanding. So my teacher, Bernie Glassman, used to say that through practice of many, many years, particularly doing meditation, that you can come to a place which he used to call the realization and the manifestation of the oneness of life. And that space is pretty much what Spinoza was talking about in different language, without having anything to do with Zen, the Buddhism, or whatever it is. And many other people have talked about that.
I think that, and I always go back to, you know, early childhood education in these things, because, you know, that early programming is what is the foundation that is built for everything coming after that. And so besides not learning, or children not understanding that they don't have to be one thing, they can be many things, right? These sort of societal norms, or what is right or wrong, or what is acceptable or correct, is really instilled early. You know, even when you go to a school and you look at the kindergarten artwork, right? And it all looks the same, you know, except for slight variations. You know, the teacher puts the project and this is what we're making, and so everybody makes that, right? And everybody gets the same. You all get 2 googly eyes, you all get 5 feathers, you know, everybody gets the same materials, they get everything the same. It's not something that they can choose, right? It isn't an open topic. And I also understand that it's because it's also more efficient. I get it. You got all these kids, you only have 20 minutes to do the project, right? But that's also the issue I see, is that the time that it takes for the brain to make this beautiful shift in focus isn't there, right? That you really have to be in this micro focus, or, you know, the noodling, when you noodle, you know, when you see little kids in a sandbox and they're just there and they're in it, they're so engulfed in what they're doing, or when their little kid is digging a mud hole, or, you know, when they're just playing with blocks or whatever, and you just peek in and you see that they are so in another planet, right? That you just back away and let them be there. You know, they are far away. When you go to school, you're not allowed to do that. You cannot go far away. Your mind cannot go far away. And what I've seen is that in the moment where finally, you know, you see the little brain starting to, oh, time's up, make a line, we have to switch.
Paco, stop looking out the window. I was always looking out the window. And he would scream at me.
Yeah.
Francisco, stop looking out the window. Look at me.
Yeah.
And I was daydreaming.
Yeah, you cannot.
I was daydreaming.
Cannot go far away.
I've never stopped daydreaming, but I used to get screamed. I used to get into trouble with. I understand what you're saying. Absolutely.
Yeah, the time. In dance, it's a little bit different. And I say a little bit because things have also changed. Fortunately, not in the environments that I teach. Thank goodness, I'm still in the room for a very long time. Some of my classes can run up to 2.5 hours, just one class. So I love that, because to get them to focus for that long and to finally, by the end of the year, see them completely in that, like the wheels turning and, you know, just being with themselves. You know, it's like, just be with yourself. It's very hard. It's very hard now that the minds and the attention spans are very different because of technology. So this long durational focus and being with yourself doesn't exist. You know, it doesn't exist except in art making. Except in art making, as far as, you know, people who are professional artists and students who are studying to be artists. But as far as the artistic practices in education, it just doesn't exist, because the time that is needed to find yourself, to be with yourself, and to really make something original is not granted. It's, you know. So it goes back to, okay, everybody gets 2 googly eyes, you all get 3 pom-poms, here's what you're making, and everybody makes it, yeah. And you stick it on the wall.
So, you know, we could go, and there'll be probably a separate podcast where we talk about the educational system and what the educational system does and doesn't do. You know, there was a study made many, many years ago, still around in YouTube, where they did a sort of the equivalent of an IQ for kindergarten kids. And they tested kindergarten kids for creativity. And they did the test a couple of times. They beta tested it, whatever it is. And because they thought it was wrong, every time they tested kindergarten kids, 100% tested artistically inclined, 100%. Mm-hmm. So then they did a longitudinal study and they followed the same kids. By the age of 6 or 7, when they were already in the 5th grade, 6th grade, or whatever it is, only 30% of the 100% tested artistically. So what is the system does to drive out there to exactly what you were saying? Paco stopped looking out the window, whatever it is. Maybe Paco needed to stop looking out the window, but there was a different way of addressing that. So that's a different kind of a subject that it's a subject in itself. It's huge, what the school system and the way we teach.
But when we bring it back to finding joy in your work, and then you backtrack to who are you? In the first place, you know, like what makes you tick? How do you think, right?
Yeah, that's where I was going. Yeah. I was going with that because at the age of 85, I began to really drill down. And the reason I'm studying Baruch Espinosa again after 100 years ago that I got into Baruch Espinosa because I went to a liberal arts college and we saw all the philosophers and all of that stuff is because he addresses the whole issue of cause and effect. Cause and effect as it deals with an individual's development and evolvement, right? So in looking at myself, I've shared with you in different conversations that before I got to the 1st grade, my mother in Puerto Rico would take the brown paper bags, open them up, unglue them, and make us memorize the times table. She also taught us the ABCs and everything else. So by the time we got to the 1st grade, we knew our timetables, memorized, and they could test us 20 ways down the middle, forward, backwards, and we knew them. That foundational thing that my mother did for both myself and my 2 sisters created who we were going to become in many, many ways. Because in the first few grades that we were in, we were showing tremendous amount of aptitude and joy and victory compared to the other kids, which most of them had to start all over them. They had to do that. So we were considered smart kids, which may have been that we were smart, but it's just that my mother got us to do that. So that become foundational in terms of what we do. So we now push the film forward, and we're into a situation where, as an adult, you have to make a decision about the kinds of things that you do, what you don't do, whatever it is. That foundational principle is inside your brain somewhere, and it helps. It's a cause of certain things that happen in your life. In a negative form, when I was in Puerto Rico, I was 6 years old, my father left for the United States for 4 or 5 years. He was my love. He was my idol. He was my adoration. As far as I was concerned, he abandoned me. And I used to go for weeks to the bus stop to wait for him until my mother got really pissed off at me and said, "You're never going to come out here again." That was even worse. I was abandoned. So that became part of my psyche. So as I grew up, whether I liked it or not, I was always looking for abandonment in my relationships. I didn't know that. So those things in your earlier part of the conversation is very foundational. And most of us in saying, who am I, can't get there, won't get there, don't know how to get there. Some of us go to therapy for years and years and years, and we still don't get there. But it does affect the level of work that you do or the level of vocation that you do and to the level that you can really enjoy it to the point that you find, you know, a contentment and a pride about what you do. Because pride was part of work. You know, I tell my students sometimes, you know, I tell them the story that this guy goes to see where they're building this huge building, and he know what the building is, and the building hasn't been built. He hasn't seen the architectural renderings or anything else like that. And he finds a guy making a hole. And he asks one guy, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm making a hole for a building." He goes to another guy who's digging a hole. He says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm building a cathedral." And I think that that's the important part. For some reason, one guy was building a hole and another guy had a different view, whatever it was. He was building a cathedral. He was just doing a hole.
When we find purpose, we find intentional actions, right? And purpose and function and importance in our work, seeing the bigger picture, right? Seeing the bigger picture. And that was also, I think, and still is, you know, when you find the work or the place where you fit in, you also understand that you are one wheel of many. And that each wheel or each segment is so important because everybody understands the greater good, the greater function, the greater purpose, right? And so even though my job is only this much, without it, things fall apart, right? And I think that's very important too. You know, what is my little contribution to the bigger, important thing? Yeah. This is also sort of makes me think about legacy. Is your work your legacy? Or are you part of somebody else's legacy?
Hold on to that thought, because maybe we'll end up with that thought of legacy. What is it you leave behind? But present day, where we're living right now, the word work changed right before our own very eyes. In 2020, we had something called the pandemic. The pandemic then put people in their homes. 90% of the world, or I don't know how much of the world, ended up, at least people in the Western world and Europe, who were working in office buildings. In fact, they had to go home and try to figure out if, in fact, they could work from home.
When before, the answer to that question for everybody was, oh, no, I could never work from home.
That's right.
Oh, you can't work from
home. That's right. That's right.
This does not work.
That's
right.
That's right.
Everything was no. And all of a sudden.
That's right. So now the pandemic happens. All these people are home. And all of a sudden, they have to work and shit. You know, I got children. Oh, my God. Children that didn't see their parents for 7-8 hours during the day. All of us went through that in many, many ways as growing up. Now, all of a sudden, the parents were home. Relationship have to be built with the kids. Relationship have to be built with what is called your work or your task or whatever it is. It changed dramatically. There's no such a thing as work as we knew it, because as we know, in every major city in the United States, from Boston to Chicago to Philadelphia to L.A. to Miami, wherever it is, buildings are now with huge, huge vacancy rates because no one wants to go back. Well, no one wants to wear a suit and a tie anymore, except bankers. And I've seen bankers now. I've gone into a bank where I've seen some people without ties. It has changed dramatically, that whole concept that we had already put in, which we inherited again from the Industrial Revolution and the post-industrial revolution. So right now we're going through another change, which is with technology advancing certain kinds of ideas that machines are now doing things better than humans can do. And it can, on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, every 6 months, it's growing by leaps and bounds. So that ultimately, we're now, you know, the Chinese curse is, may you live in interesting times. So now we're living in interesting times 10x, tenfold. And so what you and I are discussing is our own experience in a linear world. We now have transformed into an exponential world, a world that's moving at a speed so rapidly that it's very, very difficult for the neurological synapses in our brains to really understand. Even for some of us that study it, we don't know.
It's funny because those who work the 9-to-5, you know, they have to put in the 40 hours, go to the office, you know, all that stuff. I think that switch in the world obviously affected that population the most and still is affecting. You know, companies are figuring out, because a lot of the workforce is working from home, that in a lot of cases productivity has increased. it did not affect your bottom line. In fact, it helped your bottom line because now you got rid of rent. Now you're not renting or leasing a space anymore, right? So I see that. For those of us who are not and have never been, again, I'm talking about the creatives, right? Have always had an odd schedule, you know, night owls, rehearsals at strange hours, teaching during afternoon to evening hours. Some artists get up at 3 a.m. and that's their work. You know, like that we don't live in the paradigm of maybe quote unquote the norm. For a lot of us, the staying home or that sort of odd schedule, I don't think it felt that different for us. It was like, oh, okay. You know, because we don't go to the 9-to-5, right? So it's funny, you know, going back to, again, knowing yourself and also understanding when you don't fit into what society thinks is normal, right? A lot of people are, I don't understand your schedule. What do you mean you don't? What do you mean your schedule is changing? Like, because of what I do. Because of what I do.
I submit several things. Number one, that because of the things that I explained to how the world is changing, civilization is going more and more towards what you did as an artist, as a creator. You basically talk about this is what I do or this is what I did. I submit with all due respect, you don't do anything. It's who you are. And that's a significant difference than what you are is the stuff that manifested itself in movement or whatever it is. Right. It is not a new thing. In the Greek civilizations and the times of Aristotle and some of the philosophers, art, politics, and living were all one.
As it should be.
So society is moving towards that. I've said many, many times publicly that I believe the artistic community are really the sages, present-day sages, present-day people with wisdom. The only thing is that, you know, society as we've known it up to this point has marginalized the artists. When there was budget cuts in our schools, what was the first thing that got cut? Yep. It was artistic programs. Yep. The artistic programs. And so we've been misaligned with that situation for a long time. I think we're coming to a point where we're going to be realigning. And so we're living through an era that has been coined by Peter Diamandis in his book, Abundance, in which abundance is not more of, but a definition of possibilities, which is what an artist works with, no matter what artist it is. Mm-hmm. Artist works with possibilities, whether it's a dance, whether it's a step, whether it's a jazz composition or a classical composition or opera. If you're always working with possibilities as you're creating and as you're performing it, which is what you're talking about, right? So my sense of it is that unless I'm totally wrong, that's the way society is moving to, you know. And so people who, you know, the other day I saw a show where the woman who was in charge of, I may be making this up a little bit, fabricating it, but she was in charge of a major department for Starbucks for 15 years. She was an attorney. She retired. And she all of a sudden found her music and her singing, and she's now performing, you know, with a band and everything else. And she showed her performance, you know, from that thing of being out there, she now found the abundance of possibility that she could really be who she really wanted to be all along.
Right.
I think that's an exciting piece that some people tend to look at where we are right now and AI and AGI and quantum computing, and people go negative on that stuff. I've always been an addictive optimist in my life, and I think that that's also part of why I've gotten here, in quotes, fairly healthy, you know, so.
But yeah. I think that the process of art, you don't have to become a professional artist, right? But just the act of doing, the act of being in the material things and in the noodling and in the act of possibilities, is the kind of knowledge building that has to come back and that will bring a balance, because the world is going to be and is so computerized, right? And it's just going to get more and more that kind of thinking is what's going to create a balance so that the pendulum doesn't fall off the side.
Yeah, and we have to redefine our words. You know, knowledge has been democratized. Information has been democratized. What does that mean? I don't have to go to college to get knowledge. I don't have to go to college to get information. I got Uncle Google. I got Uncle YouTube. I have a lot of uncles. I have AGI GPT-4. I have 3 co-pilots that will give me all the information that I need. What they can give me, though, is my sense of intuition, my sense of feeling. And that, to me, is what you're addressing, that from an artistic point of view, you do not have to be a sculptor or a painter or a dancer. You have to be in tune again with your essence, who you are from a feeling point of view, from a sense point of view, from understanding and following up the sense that you've always had, that you've always loved nature, that you've always gone on these walks or you're going to the beach and you get this feeling. You got to pursue that because that's where the possibilities are. That's where the possibilities are. And I think we're moving in that direction more and more because I think that the technology is going to take care of the things that were laborious and boring. And they can do that better than we can, which I believe, I choose to believe, will open up a space of freedom for a lot of people, for all people all over the world. One of the things about this thing is that this has also been democratized. You know, this ability for you to enter whatever it is that you think you need to do artistically has been totally democratized. No, don't become an artist because artists starve to death. I mean, how many kids were sent doing that sort of thing, you know?
Right.
Peter Diamandis's Greek father and mother said to them, you need to become a doctor. So he did. He went to Harvard, got a doctor's degree. He always wanted to do rocketry. He wanted to go to space. He wants to build the first full community in the moon. He did that since he was a kid. So he went to Harvard, got the degree, put the degree in an envelope, said, Mom and Dad, I did what you wanted me to do. Now I'm going to do what I wanted. There's going to be more and more people like that in the world, in my opinion. And part of what you bring to this conversation and this world is that what people are now discovering you've done for 20, 30 years.
Right.
And along with your other colleagues, you know, the people that have been called loco, no schedules, staying up at night, getting up late in the morning, eso loco, eso artista loco. They've had all kinds of names for it. I think that that's going to become pretty much the norm by either you shift that way or you don't survive.
Right.
I mean, it gets to that point. That's not an over-dramatization from my perspective. So let's close with what I interrupted you on based on positioning that we've put for work and joy and joyfulness in terms of what you think legacy is. So let's personalize it. What is the legacy that you want to leave your kids or the world or anything, if there's such a thing as you wanting to live a legacy?
I don't know. I don't think I've thought about my legacy. I think because I'm just trying to really clarify the purposefulness, I don't know if that's a word, of of what I do. I always say when I teach, and when I'm teaching movement, I'm doing so for very different reasons. I take the performance out of it because once people say, you know, once people hear you're a dance teacher or you're a dancer or you're a performer, they immediately have a picture of a stage and a performance and that's it. That's the extent of it, right? And so when I take that out of the equation, I am moving bodies to move minds. And that's also the name of one of the curriculums that I have for children, moving bodies, moving minds. You know, how do we bring these students into a physical practice where they can discover who they are, where they can find how courageous they can be, how generous they can be, how they can find how strong they can be. And I think that the openness...
That's powerful. That's powerful.
To be courageous and and trust. Trust is a big thing. I have one student who will not trust, and you know, sometimes they're lazy, sometimes they're just, it's just too uncomfortable because whatever the whole society thing, and so they just, they don't want to look weird, they don't, you know, they want everything to be perfect, and if it's not perfect, right, I'm not right, coming right. to class, blah 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 right. blah. So you know, this is somebody who won't try, who's always absent, doesn't, is not interested. In the same class, I have a student who has physical disabilities, and yet here is a student, and there she is, and she's rolling across the room, and she's doing this, and she's doing that, and every whatever I do, and I say to my students, okay, you're going to play with this idea. I don't want them to do exactly what I do. I leave it open. And there she is, with all the physical disabilities, doing, and discovering, and struggling to get off the floor, and I'm looking at her, and boom, there she is. She made it to standing. And I'm like, well, there it is. That's all we need.
Wow, wow.
You just need to know that you are strong enough to do that.
Wow,
and that's
beautiful.
How brave you are.
Beautiful.
And so I guess if my legacy is a shift in how we teach movement, or the purpose for teaching movement, take the performance and the competition and all that crap out of it, right? And let's really talk about why humans need it. And that's it.
That's a beautiful legacy. That's a beautiful legacy, because in that process that you're describing, you know, you're setting the conditions so that people can find what basically we started this conversation with is who you are. And in the description that you gave of the young woman who's challenged, she probably has found out, as we were saying before, what she does is who she is, because she has challenges, which challenges from our perspective, from her perspective, is who she is. And she'll find a way of cooperating, participating is a better word, in whatever form she is. That being, you know, that being.
What do you need?
Yeah.
What do you need in order to achieve this? And that's what you need. So that's what you're going to do.
Yeah. So the legacy of changing human lives is as admirable as any, I think, is the main thing, you know, helping others and finding whatever their pathway is. So it's a beautiful, beautiful legacy. I've never thought about legacy for myself other than trying to always figure out how to be me, and that if I could be inspirationally being me, and sometimes I'm totally sacrilegious, outrageous, ill-spoken, inappropriate. I've always been rebellious about appropriateness, and to some degree it's gotten me in trouble lots and lots of times. But it was a sense of that the world that I lived in, the world that I was being taught in, the world that people wanted me to be something that I didn't want to be, they were just too damn serious. And although I had a level of devotion, I had a level of work habits, I've always worked my butt off. At the same time, I had a level of being able to see the levity of everything, to see the funny part of everything. Even bad moments, to me, had funny parts to it. And I think that has been a survival thing for me. Sometimes as a defense mechanism, I understand. But most of the time, it was something that served me well, and hopefully serve others' world. And so sometimes I tell my five children, I said, listen, I think Dad's got to grow up. I think I got to grow up. I think I got to change. I think I got to act more serious like a Zen Buddhist guide and teacher. And they said, Dad, don't change. Don't change. If you change, you're going to mess it up. So I think that speaks to my legacy a lot. And I'm happy with that. I'm happy with that. Yeah.
Good. Finding joy.
Thank you, Damaris.
Thank you, Paco.